from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at Act 12 and the idea of home rule, enshrined in Wisconsin's Constitution. We'll hear from a Brookfield senior named this year's Wisconsin Journalist of the Year.
I found the process of like interviewing people and like doing research for each article very interesting. Just kind of like bringing together different perspectives and being able to share that with others was really fulfilling to me.
Plus, we'll learn about a first-of-its-kind universal park being built right here in Milwaukee.
Whether we're talking about intellectual and developmental disabilities to physical disabilities, that's what universal is about. We're really thinking about everybody, all human experiences, and what people's needs are.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Wisconsin's spring election and presidential preference vote was yesterday. It was a crowded ballot with races for local offices, along with two constitutional amendment questions and school referendums. To go over some of the results, I'm joined now by WUWM editor and reporter Emily Files and Lake Effect production assistant Sam Woods. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Hi, Joy.
Thank you.
So, Emily, let's talk about the presidential preference vote. Donald Trump and Joe Biden are the presumptive nominees for their respective parties, but Wisconsinites still got their say in yesterday's vote. Was there anything interesting to note from those results?
So the main thing that we were looking for was how many so-called protest votes Trump and Biden received. So that would be, for example, a vote for Nikki Haley on the Republican side or an uninstructed vote on the Democratic side. Even though Haley dropped out of the race, she got about 13% of the vote in Wisconsin's Republican primary. And the uninstructed option on the Democratic ticket got about 8% of the vote. Of course, the vast majority of votes were for Trump and Biden, but those protest votes do send a message that there are a lot of Wisconsinites who aren't happy with their party's likely nominee. And in a state where presidential elections are so close, that could be the difference.
Sure. Now, Wisconsin voters approved two statewide ballot questions that will change Wisconsin's constitution. One prohibits the use of private funding to administer elections, and the other allows only election officials to administer elections. Tell us a bit more about those ballot questions, Emily.
Yeah, these questions were added to the ballot by Republican lawmakers who have concerns about election integrity. The controversy that sparked this was in 2020 when Wisconsin cities received grants to help them run elections during the COVID pandemic. And those grants were funded by Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and his wife. And there were accusations from the Republican side that the money influenced the election results. But multiple courts found the money was used legally. So now that voters approved these two constitutional amendments, groups that advocate for voting rights, like the ACLU and the League of Women Voters, say the changes could make it more difficult and confusing to run elections in Wisconsin. And speaking of confusing, there was a voter yesterday who my colleague Susan Bentz talked to who was confused between the MPS referendum and the referendums, the constitutional amendment referendums. So sometimes these constitutional amendments can be confusing to voters, but those did ultimately pass.
I think reading them, it was pretty confusing for a lot of people.
Yeah, the language is not exactly that understandable. Mm.
So moving down ballot, in Milwaukee, one of the big races was for city attorney. Incumbent Tierman Spencer was challenged by State Representative Evan Goyke. Sam, you've been covering that race. Who won and by what margin?
Yeah, so Evan Goyke won this race by about 27% of the vote, beating incumbent Tierman Spencer to become Milwaukee's next city attorney. Now, Goyke currently represents parts of Milwaukee's west side in the Wisconsin State Assembly, and he will stay in that role for now. Goyke ran on running an efficient and effective office, and given that Spencer battled staffing shortages and ethics complaints from within his office throughout his term, it really seems that this message resonated with voters. And WUWM reporter Eddie Morales was at Goyke's election night watch party last night, and he asked Goyke what his priorities will be other than cleaning up the office, and here's part of Goyke's answer.
I think reckless driving is top of mind and how municipal court operations can be improved to make sure our streets are safer. And then, you know, looking at housing and how we can hold property owners that don't keep up their housing. Good people, renters are paying huge portions of their salary. Too many of them are to live in substandard conditions, and the city attorney's intimately involved in holding landlords and, you know, problem property owners to a high standard. We intend to do that.
Goyke will begin his term on April 16th, along with all of the other city officials who won their election last night.
Now, Emily, one of the other big Milwaukee election stories is the MPS referendum. MPS was asking taxpayers to approve a property tax hike to support the school district, but it was pretty controversial. What happened there?
So MPS was asking for a $252 million funding increase, which would raise taxes by about $400 on a $200,000 home. And MPS says that money is needed simply to maintain programming because state funding hasn't kept up with inflation. My colleague Susan Benz was at the polls yesterday, as I mentioned, asking voters about the MPS referendum. Here are two voters named Sean and Kate. They're a couple, and they voted for the referendum.
We both grew up in MPS schools.
Yeah.
My mom worked for MPS.
And we agree with it. I mean, I feel that the kids, they do need more help.
After COVID, as an experience with my nieces and like her friends' kids having to do this Zoom at school, that was not a good time. So I think, you know, more money, as long as it's used the right way.
But opponents of the referendum say the assumptions MPS was making in its budget aren't realistic, and they feel there isn't a transparent plan about how the money would be spent. Milwaukee voters were really divided over this question. The vote was really close, but ultimately the referendum was approved with 51% of votes in favor and 49% against, and that's unofficial election results. So even though this is a win for MPS, it's a big change from the last time the district went to referendum in 2020. That one overwhelmingly passed. This time it barely passed. MPS will release its proposed budget for the next school year later this month, and then we'll see exactly what impact this funding boost could have.
Sure. Now, Emily, Sam, were there any other notable Milwaukee area races that we really need to talk about?
Sure. So the Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson and Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley were easily elected to second terms. Their opponents were mayoral candidate David King and County Executive candidate Aisha Griffin. There were some competitive races for a lot of the Milwaukee Common Council and County Board seats, but none of the incumbents running were unseated. And if you want to find out who will represent you on the Common Council and County Board, we have full results at WUWM.com.
All right. Well, Sam, Emily, thank you both so much for breaking down some of the results from the spring general election.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Now, you can see more election results on our website, WUWM.com. We have two more elections this year, the fall primary on August 13th and the general election on November 5th. WUWM will have voter guides for those elections as well. So let us know if you have questions that we can answer for you by filling out our election survey on the website. Did a lot of things in Wisconsin. For most municipalities, it sent more money to the community, including here in Milwaukee. But in Milwaukee, it also took power from our local government to make decisions on how to spend funds. Now, the Milwaukee Common Council is contemplating next steps as it seeks to retake some of that power. It might all come down to the concept of home rule, a principle enshrined by the state constitution. Larry Sandler is a local writer who wrote about home rule for Milwaukee Magazine. He joins me now to talk about it. What is the concept of home rule as it's laid out in Wisconsin's Constitution?
Home rule means basically that cities and villages have the right to run their own affairs. The exact language of the Constitution is to say they can determine, quote, determine their local affairs and government, unquote. And so it's a very broad power, and even perhaps more broadly defined in state law, which predates the Constitution, saying, you know, to act for the government and good order of the city, for its commercial benefit, and for the health, safety, and welfare of the public. So if you take that literally, they can do just about anything that they need to, unless it contradicts something else in the Constitution, as you would expect, or if there's a state law on matters, quote, of statewide concern, unquote, that are supposed to affect all municipalities equally.
Mm. It does seem overly broad. And I think for people who are familiar with Wisconsin politics, they're going to go, well, it seems like the legislature has a lot of power over what municipalities do. We'll get into Act 12 in just a bit. But this provision to the Constitution was enacted in the 1920s. It has been tested a number of times since then. How has the home rule provision in the Constitution been tested through the courts?
So the first court case was in 1926, and that was on the question of who had the right to say how tall the buildings could be in Milwaukee. And in that case, the state Supreme Court ruled that Milwaukee had the right to decide how tall its buildings could be, and the state legislature couldn't. So that was an early victory, but unfortunately for the city, that was really their only victory. And since then, the courts have ruled against them in a number of cases. Most strikingly, in 2016, when the court ruled against the city of Milwaukee on the question of residency. The legislature had essentially repealed the residency requirements for Milwaukee and other cities, and Milwaukee challenged that in court and lost.
It's interesting how infrequently it seems that home rule wins, because it was put into the Constitution because it was felt that there was all of this overreach from the state government into these local communities. You talk to a number of political scientists about this issue. What do they believe is the importance of the concept of home rule? Why is it enshrined in the Constitution?
So at the time that it was enacted, legislatures were way up in the city's businesses, much more than they are now, where just about everything had to go through the legislature. The city councils and village boards had very little power. And so the idea was that that didn't make a lot of sense. And so it made more sense for aldermen and village board members and mayors to make decisions about their own cities, about things that affected them. And that also meant that rural legislators were not deciding things for the city, and city legislatures weren't deciding things for the small towns.
Yeah. Now, let's dig into Act 12 a bit, because that's really what's at the heart of this conversation. For people who are unfamiliar with it, what did Act 12 do?
The primary purpose of it was to help out Milwaukee and Milwaukee County and to some extent, local governments all over the state with their fiscal problems, because state aid had not kept up with their expenses, and they were limited also by state law in their ability to tax. That's another way that the home rule had been eroded, because the state put levy limits on them. And so the primary purpose was financial aid, increasing shared revenue, allowing the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County to a new sales tax in the city's case, an increased sales tax in the county's case, and also to take over their pension systems eventually. But the legislature added all of these strings to it that really infringed, in the local officials' view, on home rule in terms of putting very specific rules down about, like, how many police officers and even how many detectives and how many firefighters and how much you spend on the police and fire department, and whether there are police in schools, and who serves on the Fire and Police Commission and taking away some of the Fire and Police Commission's powers and how you can pay for the streetcar. And so quite a lot of restrictions on, you know, what the city thought was its business.
Sure. And it seems like the vast majority of these stipulations, although Act 12 is a bill that covers the entire state, municipalities throughout the state, it seems like the majority of these stipulations were just targeted at Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. You mentioned the Fire and Police Commission, of course, the streetcar. These are things that are only in the city of Milwaukee. The Common Council has taken issue with it. It seems like is there a lawsuit currently, or is there a lawsuit that is pending, or how are they challenging these rules?
There is not currently a lawsuit. The Common Council has requested an opinion from the city attorney that was supposed to be done by January 1st. I'm not sure if it is yet. But once that opinion is in, the aldermen will look at that and decide whether they want to file a suit. I know the mayor is not too enthusiastic about that idea, and it probably would get a negative reaction from the state legislature as well.
How does the state legislature, I guess, justify having all of these stipulations on these funds, especially when we look at the origin of the shared revenue program, in which this was really money that was meant to be used by municipalities as they saw fit, as they chose?
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, you know, the shared revenue program originated at the same time as the state income tax, and the local governments were supposed to get a share of the state income tax, in fact, the majority share of the state income tax, and things have obviously changed a lot since then. But the legislature approached this, you know, really from sort of a quid pro quo standpoint, that you want something from us, we want something from you. And they felt that they had the right to put on these stipulations. And I also quoted some political scientists as saying that the legislature has been catering to certain interest groups, and the fire and police unions are among those interest groups. You know, they are generally aligned more with Republicans. And so in the residency case and very much in Act 12, you saw that the Republican-led legislature was taking actions that benefited those unions' members.
Mm. It's interesting that they view this as kind of a quid pro quo because, of course, as you just mentioned, this is money that we've all sent in. It's not as though this is money that the legislature made somehow in other ways. It's money that comes from all of these communities, including Milwaukee, much of it coming from Milwaukee and the surrounding areas. So the idea that they're doing us a favor by giving us back our money and so they have to put all these new strings on it, It does seem a little odd.
Yeah, I think it seems odd to the local officials also. But again, as you mentioned, you know, we've gotten away a lot from the original idea of shared revenue. And so it doesn't have the linkage that it used to have to being a share of the income tax. And now it's really just, you know, an appropriation by the legislature, just like all the other appropriations that they make for school aid and universities and prisons and so forth.
Even though the money is still coming from...
Well, it's all coming from us, the taxpayers, but that's true of all the other money that they spend, too.
Sure. So what's next for this?
Well, really, you know, as we discussed, the question will be whether the city chooses to sue or whether they choose to make do. I understand that Milwaukee Public Schools has not yet come through with a plan for how they're going to bring the police back into the schools, which they really didn't want to do, and they weren't even part of this negotiation. And I know that there are aldermen and other city officials who are also looking at how to pay for streetcar expansion with the new restrictions of not being able to use tax incremental financing districts, which were the primary way of paying for it. And so that's really the choice that the city's going to have is, do you challenge it in court? Do you try to lobby to get the legislature to change it? Or do you just figure out some ways to make do?
Sure. Well, Larry, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, sharing your work. I look forward to seeing what happens.
Thank you, Joy. It's been a pleasure.
Sandler is a local writer. We spoke earlier this year. Later in the show, we'll speak with the founder of Kothi Dance Company, which is celebrating 55 years and over 1 million children impacted in Milwaukee. But first, we'll meet the high school senior named Journalist of the Year by the Wisconsin Journalism Education Association. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. To Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Iman Mir is a senior at Brookfield East High School and has been working in journalism since middle school. Her years of hard work recently paid off when she was named Journalist of the Year by the Wisconsin Journalism Education Association. The award recognizes high school students for outstanding work in journalism and comes with a $1,000 scholarship. Mir joins Lake Effect's Excret Nunez to share more of her story.
You're in your senior year of high school, but how long have you been working in journalism?
I'd say my first exposure to journalism was probably in middle school. I was part of like our news network, which is kind of like a broadcast journalism program. I typically did like sports stories through that. I would like interview kids after they're done with like their cross-country races and stuff like that. Definitely built my confidence a lot. And then coming into high school, I joined my school's newspaper.
How did you first become interested in journalism?
I think growing up, I was just always fascinated with the idea of like storytelling. I read a lot of books, and I wouldn't say I was like super fond of writing at first, but I think that kind of like it grew on me slowly. Like I kind of started with like design for Spartan Banner, but then I was like asked to write a couple of articles, and I found the process of like interviewing people and like doing research for each article very interesting. Just kind of like bringing together different perspectives and being able to share that with others was really fulfilling to me.
Yeah, I love that. I think I can share similarly in why I got into journalism. What are the types of stories you enjoy telling in your journalism work?
I like to tell stories about like the people around me and underrepresented stories typically. I think like some of my favorite stories are probably one was about like the HVAC department at our school. It was a little unexpected too, because I wanted to like focus on like how like the classroom climates at our school are like very different. Like each classroom, one is super hot, one is super cold. And I ended up like interviewing like the HVAC director, and I learned like a ton about like how that works at school. And it was kind of interesting because it was like I didn't know any of this stuff. No one else probably knew about this stuff. But yeah, coming across like these things like on a whim. And then in addition to that, I did like an article about AAPI month, which I found really fulfilling. I did like research about the month, and then like I interviewed a bunch of students. But yeah, I really like bringing in all those perspectives to that one too.
Do you have a favorite story you've reported on or a memory you look fondly back on?
I'd say the one about the AAPI month was definitely one of my favorites. And then I wrote a story about Nazia Hassan, who is a Pakistani pop artist from like the 1980s. I wrote that story for the High School Insider, which is like a program through the Los Angeles Times. I just kind of like went through like what her like experience was like as being like a pioneer in like the pop music industry in Pakistan, and kind of like the struggles and like what she had to overcome in order to like get to where she was.
I know you've also worked with middle schoolers and helped them engage in journalism. Why is this something you wanted to do?
I really wanted to show them kind of like what like journalism can look like earlier on. There aren't really that many opportunities to get involved with journalism in middle school. And I think especially like working with eighth graders who are like already kind of excited, maybe a little nervous for high school, I kind of wanted to tap into that and like speak to them. But overall, I just think mentorship is like really important in any field. I remember when I first started writing for the Spartan Banner, I mean, there was a lot of confusion about how to write an article, how is this different from my English essays, and I really wanted to help minimize that and make it easier for students to just voice what they have to say instead of, like, focusing on the little, like, nitpicky details and learn that earlier on.
Yeah, I don't know if there's like a lot of access sometimes to journalism early on. So that's so you've been recognized as Wisconsin's Journalist of the Year. What does this award mean to you?
I mean, I'm really honored to share this excitement with people, and I'm definitely more inspired to like pursue journalism at like a higher level, especially when it comes to like college and like writing for like a college newspaper.
And you're wrapping up your senior year of high school in a few months. What are you hoping to do in the future?
I'm planning on going to a four-year university and probably majoring in public health and possibly minoring in journalism.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about that.
So journalism has really inspired me to like seek stories and like learn from others. And I've really enjoyed getting the opportunity to like interview people and like health professionals. And I think that's where my inspiration to study public health comes from, because I'll be able to like continue to tell stories about like healthcare equity and like stuff that I've already been kind of doing with my blog. But I'll also be able to have the ability to like change and like shape those stories as well.
So, Iman, as you're wrapping up your senior year of high school, is there any advice you have for future young journalists?
I'd say my first piece of advice is to, like, focus on, like, writing stories that, like, bigger news networks can't cover. I'd say, like, they don't have access to, like, other students and, like, teachers and to, like, your community to the extent that they do. And you should really try to focus on, like, getting those perspectives, like, through interviews. And don't be shy. Like, interview people in person instead of over email. Be confident in how you write. And it's whatever you're writing, it's probably better than you think it is. So keep going.
Well, Iman, thank you so much for speaking with me today. And I really look forward to seeing what you have in store for the world.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Iman Mir is this year's Wisconsin Journalist of the Year. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez. When some people go to a park, they can run, jump, and play without a second thought. But for others, it's more complicated. Some paths aren't accessible for those with mobility devices, and some playgrounds don't accommodate visual or physical limitations. And if there are accessible components, the rest of the spaces might not be enticing for people without disabilities. That's why Damian Bookman, executive director of the Ability Center, knew it was time for a change. He's spearheading the first of its kind Moss Universal Park, an area in the works in Milwaukee where everyone can play, whether they have a disability or not. WUWM's Mayan Silver speaks with him to find out more.
So one of the key principles of this project is that everyone should have access to play and recreation whenever they want it. How is this message personal to you?
Well, it's a great question. So, you know, what makes this so personable for me is actually I was diagnosed with childhood cancer when I was 13 years old in my right leg and re-diagnosed in my left leg. So I've had 28 knee replacements and revisions since I was a kid. But more importantly, I'm a father of three boys, and I want to be able to play with my boys regardless of where my ability or mobility is found. And they want to play with me. And I think that's our most important message, is that we will build, you know, inclusive playgrounds for kids. And I think that that's really great. But every kid looks back to the adult who brought them. Mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle, teachers. Hey, look what I can do. And it's, much better, much more fun, much more interactive when I can get in that play instead of just looking at that play. And the kids want to play with us too. So making sure that that park, that playground works for everyone is what's most important to us.
So for people who may or may not know, can you break down what makes a playground accessible? What makes a park accessible? That kind of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, if we can picture a playground, just about every playground sits inside of a park, right? And we believe that that whole park should be an inclusive and universal experience, not just the playground alone, that people should be able to explore the outside of that space. I think one of the major issues with inclusive playgrounds is their sense of adventure and their sense of danger and their sense of really wanting to be able to activate doesn't exist in many inclusive playgrounds, which what then that creates is just an opportunity for the able-bodied, you know, siblings and peers to feel a little bored and ready to leave. And let's be real, it probably gets boring pretty fast for kids with disabilities as well. So we've got to bring more activity, more adventure, more danger into the design. And then when we do that, that actually it provides and creates inclusive play, ultimately what we're looking for. If it's not an entertaining space to play, then those typically developing peers that come to play with their peers or siblings with disabilities, well, they're probably gone in 60 seconds or less. And they've already played on that element and that playground and that space, and they're no longer entertained and they're gone. So what we didn't create was that actual inclusion that we're looking for. We certainly created an accessible opportunities for kids and individuals with disabilities to play, but we didn't create inclusion if it's also not adventurous and dangerous and fun for the able-bodied kids.
And so can you break down engineering-wise or structural-wise, what are some of the components that make a playground and a park having those elements?
Yeah. Well, so from a playground perspective, you know, we're helping create the first ever wheelchair chute or wheelchair slide, if you will, that's never been done before. We've created something called Inclusion Tower, and we're talking about sensory needs to physical needs and challenges across the whole spectrum, right? And this will get kids that can have the capacity to climb that up to 12 feet. You know, not every child with a physical impairment is wheelchair bound. A lot of times, you know, society likes to say somebody is wheelchair bound. The reality is that they are wheelchair users or they're a mobility device user. They don't need it at all times at, you know, of every second of every day. And so they can get out of that chair and climb something if they have that capacity. So that's what Inclusion Tower is. So imagine we're actually getting them 12 feet off the ground versus just 4 or 8, but also double wide ramps so that, you know, children who are wheelchair users are not in, you know, the way. They feel welcome, wanted, and comfortable when they're playing, and that they can interact in a multitude of ways. But then also usually ramp structures have one way in and one way out. It's the same thing. It's the same experience every time that a child plays that comes that has that need. And how much fun is that, right? When you think about a typically developing child or individuals, you know, we have ladders to climb, or we have nets to climb, or we have slides to climb, we have poles to climb. We have a lot of ways in and a lot of ways out of a structure. But a child who might be a wheelchair user has the same way in as the same way out. And my play experience never changes every time I come. So we have multiple way-ins, multiple ways out, not just the same experience in a structure, again, that brings that sense of adventure and danger by getting people up to 8 and 12 feet high versus maybe 2 to 4 feet high.
It's also been talked about that there will be a half mile accessible path through the woods that include a challenge course.
That's right.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so if we go beyond the playground, right, there's also a universal baseball field, something that's never been built before or designed before, that will be able to include a multitude of sports, including wheelchair football and wheelchair basketball. But if we merge ourselves into the forestry, everybody knows that nature is good for our mental health. And we like to say everybody deserves to hug a tree. And those trees are fantastic in the Milwaukee County parks. But if you can't get to the tree, does the tree really exist, is the question. And so we have created a half a mile meandering path that will go through about the 12 acres of the wooded area, even a spot where we call sensory escape or mental health valley, where you can get surrounded by nature and be kind of in a cocoon or a pod and escape from the visual activity, the auditory activity, the things that might just be too overwhelming. You can escape into that mental health valley. And so you can really get out into play pockets and fitness pockets and, yes, an inclusive challenge course. So our partner Game Time has created a challenge course, but we as the Ability Center and a partner help say, well, how is that challenge course inclusive? And so we created an inclusive model where I can race against my typically developing friend or able-bodied friend, and we can play together. And it has sensory spaces inside of that challenge course as well. And so whether we're talking about intellectual and developmental disabilities to physical disabilities, that's what Universal is about. We're really thinking about everybody, all human experiences, and what people's needs are as individuals versus, you know, kind of a perceived collective whole.
You're tuned into Lake Effect. I'm WEWM's Ayan Silver, speaking with Damian Bookman of the Ability Center. So the park is on the west side of Milwaukee off of Wisconsin Avenue. Can you describe what's beneficial about the location of this park to serve people with disabilities?
That's a really great question. I mean, we chose the park specifically because of its equity for people with disabilities. So the location is less than a mile from the level one trauma care center in the Milwaukee area. So Frederick Hospital, Children's Hospital, Medical College of Wisconsin, Ronald McDonald House. It's a block from the Milwaukee County Zoo. It's across the street from a significant elderly home known as St. Camillus and also Kitty Corner to Frederick's Rehab Hospital. It's on top of the zoo interchange. It is, you know, pretty close to the border of Milwaukee County and Waukesha County. And then it's also makes it accessible to Transit One, you know, van line systems for people who get transportation needs, but also the heaviest traveled bus route in the entire system of the Milwaukee County Transit, which allows for less mountains, if you will, that people have to climb in order to get to their ultimate destination. So really, from an accessibility and transport standpoint, this is the most accessible location from a Milwaukee County park perspective that people can get to and are familiar with the area.
So you've said you like opportunities for people with disabilities and people without disabilities, or rather people of all abilities, to play side by side and ideally together. Can you lay out some of your dreams of how this park will accomplish that?
I mean, the dream for me, I think, is the dream for everybody. It's ultimately that inclusion piece, right? So I already spoke earlier about how a lot of times inclusive playgrounds are low element, lack adventure, lack danger, lack a desire to really want to play. And so did we really create inclusion, or did we create an opportunity for kids with disabilities to play, which, don't get me wrong, is extraordinarily important, but we didn't create that inclusion. And oftentimes when we talk about things like the universal baseball field, many times those are separate on their own, not surrounded by typical able-bodied athletic baseball fields, but these are right next to each other. And so it creates that opportunity where you can have, say, a high school baseball game going alongside a Miracle League baseball game, and people are connecting together, seeing one another and seeing what their capabilities and their abilities really are. And that's what inclusion is. A community comes with people who are, you know, blind or visually impaired or deaf or hard of hearing or, you know, physically challenged or sensory issues or autism or Down syndrome or typically developing or neurotypical. I mean, it's all of the things, right? And that's what we're saying. That's what universal is. We're saying that from the fields to the forestry, from the playground to the fitness, from the bathroom, you know, and special care needs to temperature regulation, we don't want anybody to leave the park until they're exhausted, not because they have some kind of special care need. And that's what community inclusion looks like. And that's the lens we're using when we design these opportunities. And you hit it right on the head. It is all about opportunity. Is the opportunity equal? Is the opportunity accessible? Are the opportunities, right? And I think that's key in the plurality of it. Are the opportunities available?
Damian Bookman of the Ability Center, thanks so much for speaking to us about Moss Universal Park.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having us on and allowing us to share the vision and the dream and the passion and the need so that we can be a more inclusive community.
Damian Bookman is the executive director of the Ability Center. Last year, he spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver about the first of its kind Moss Universal Park. You can find more information about it at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll tell you about Kothi Dance Company, which is celebrating 55 years in Milwaukee. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Kothi Dance Company is celebrating 55 years in Milwaukee. The company, founded by Fern Calker in 1969, performs and teaches dance and music created by Africans and the African diaspora. I spoke with Calker earlier this year to explore the roots of this company and how they're celebrating its 5.5 decades in existence. How do you describe Kothi Dance Company?
You know, We have always, and I guess at the beginning when I started the company, it was in Ghana, actually, in 1969. I was sitting on the sands looking out at the Atlantic Ocean right outside of the slave fort called Elmina Castle, which was supported by the British, the Portuguese, and the Americans were all part of that slave trade. And as I was sitting there looking out toward the fort in 1969, and then was sitting there on the beach, and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do as an artist. And I know that the African dance and music was very close to my heart, having been born there and then moving here to the United States. So that's when a revelation came for me to start a dance group to see if I could become a connector between the African arts and aesthetics in the continent and African Americans over here. The name Kofi came from my father's language, the Shebro people in Sierra Leone. He was African and had met my mother at the University of Chicago, who was African American, and then they went to Sierra Leone. And it means go black. Go black is a color. The color black is thi, but I wanted it to refer to black culture, wherever that is in the diaspora. So from the very beginning, when I created the company, I've always thought of it as growing it into being this accessible place where people could touch tone the African continent through the aesthetics of the African continent. And then that took us on a journey from 1969 to present, researching and developing and creating and teaching wherever Africans ended up. Because for us to be on this journey, we couldn't ignore the process of enslavement. Because the question is, how did Africans end up in Brazil? And how did those black people end up in the Caribbean? We can't just suddenly, you know, wipe that out and ignore what happened. There's a reason why all those people ended up in the South and ended up in Brazil, in South America, and ended up in the Caribbean. So with them was an embodiment of music, song, dance, aesthetics, art, theater, poetry, literature. And so that's what we do in Kofi. We study this, we bring master teachers in, and that's been our mission to promulgate, or as they say, to spread, to give people an opportunity to explore. And this is a long definition, but it's not about, this is just for black people, because when I guess one of the problems I'm having today, this will probably take us down another road, but is it this movement that you can't teach black history with the rawness of what actually happened, because it might offend children who are descendants of people who potentially were some of the perpetrators. But that is a losing and a really sad, sad argument, because that means that all these years in my life, the first 40 years of my life, and I'm in my mid-70s, past mid-70s now, that I should have been offended all those years when I was just learning Greek mythology and British history as a child from the colonial era. I should have been offended because I wasn't learning anything about people who looked like me. So those arguments just don't wash with me.
That actually, that kind of gets to my next question for you. Going back to 1969, when you founded Kofi, what was the dance scene like in Milwaukee?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, in the 60s, well, you weren't born then, I don't think. But in the 60s, you know, that was, you know, I'm black and I'm proud. And it was the whole renaissance in the black community of touchstoning something that was cultural, the dashikis and the afros and all of that. That was a very interesting period of time where there was a lot of interest. You know, Osibisa, the Ghanaian band, had written a song called Welcome Home, which was really interesting because they played that when we went back this, just when I went this time in 2023, 24, you know, they were playing their song that they wrote in the 60s to the African-Americans who had just landed when we got to the airport. That's what they played. And so, you know, that whole era of black dance and, you know, Alvin Ailey was inside of that milieu. Catherine Dunham, all these people, Chief Bey, Rod Rogers, all these black choreographers were very active and their companies had just started and they were very, very visible. So it was a full range of music, song, and dance that was going on. People were doing African dance and playing African drums, even though they hadn't trained in any of it because nobody was really exposed. until around, I'd say, the 70s, when we started getting national dance companies from Africa touring the world, and they would stop off, like in Chicago, or Les Ballets Africains, for example, came to Milwaukee, and people started seeing the real deal and studying, and then people started going to Africa to study and then bringing African artists back to the Milwaukee area. And that's how it built.
As you look back at the last five decades of Kothi in Milwaukee, how do you think it has changed and affected the dance scene and the art scene more generally in Milwaukee?
One of the things I'm most proud of, and I think those of us who are in the current leadership in the organization, is that we teach on multiple levels. In terms of impact, I'm a part of a group called SMAC, a small arts cohort. There's 11 of us that are fundraising to raise funds to so we can keep our organizations afloat. And one of the tasks we had was to lay out in all the years that we've been functioning, how many children we've reached, blah, 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 blah. And when I started putting it all and adding it together, I realized, oh my God, Kothi has touched over 1 million children in our 54 years, going into the 55th year. You can't put money on that. I mean, it would be nice if somebody would say, you know what, this story really makes me want to send them a check. It would be nice to have some money but there is no fund large enough to equate that human experience. So I feel that Kothi is not just about teaching children and teaching the community and having classes and exposing all children, all races, all ages and humans, but it's about affecting not only the person in the class, but who they affect when they leave the class or they come back into the classroom. So I know that we have, after five decades, a long, long history with not just individuals, but with them and their families. We have a long, long history as the oldest African-American Black arts organization in the state of Wisconsin. And that's something to be celebrated. That can't be taken away from us. Not a perfect organization, by no means, but our legacy is real clear.
Yeah. Now, Kothi is celebrating its 55th anniversary, which is a big accomplishment for any organization, but especially a dance company.
Yes. In this day and age, yes.
Yeah. How are you planning to celebrate these 55 years this year? What are the performances that you have lined up?
Right now, there's some key things happening. One of the things we decided to do was, in terms of image, you know, what was going to be our theme for this year? And one of the natural things that has always fascinated me in my trips to Africa is the baobab tree, which is a very ancient tree like the redwoods. And it looks like an upside down tree with the roots at the top and great big root system. In the old days, they used to bury the griots or the storytellers inside of the roots of the baobab tree. So we decided that we wanted to honor that tree and its legacy and how old some of those trees can be. The 55th year celebration is called Under the Baobab Tree. And we have a series of events that are going to harness and bring everybody together, alumni and the community. We're starting off first, though, with a fundraiser February 21st at Panera Bread on Port Washington in Glendale. Between 4 and 8 p.m. on February 21, you can come in the store and buy anything you want there, and coffee and sweet buns or what have you. And Kothi receives 25% of the receipts. So February 21, you want to support Kothi, stop over at Panera Bread. And then April 6th, we're going to have our concert, which is titled Under the Baobab Tree. We'll be at Pius High School in Wauwatosa, 7:30 p.m. May 4th, we have two things happening on that date. On that Saturday during the day between 10 and 4, we will have a conference of African dance and drumming with guest teachers coming in. It's going to be very exciting. This is our second time doing a conference. And then that night will be in the union at UWM. Both the classes will be in UWM Mitchell Hall. And then in that evening, 5:30 to 10, May 4th, we'll be in the union, where we're going to have a bantaba slash party to celebrate the 55th year. And there's some surprises that are going to happen with that too. So that'll all be announced very soon. And then May 5th, that Sunday, we're continuing with the conference in African dance and drumming and some potential panel discussion, et cetera. So that's just the first part, taking us up to the spring. There'll be more things that we'll be announcing for later in the summer and into the fall and to the end of the year.
A lot to look forward to. Fern, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and congratulations on this really momentous anniversary.
I appreciate you, Joy.
Fern Cocker is the founder of Kothi Dance Company. She's a board member for the organization, and she's currently the interim executive director. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from the chef and founder of SapSap, which serves Laotian fare in Milwaukee, and learn about the decision to move away from brick and mortar and do more pop-ups. Plus, we'll tell you about this weekend's Men of Color Summit happening in Madison. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.